The Little Missouri River flows through the heart of the Badlands. Like most other plains rivers, has a broad, shallow bed. The river flows in long sigmoid curves through an alluvial valley of no great width. The amount of this alluvial land enclosed by a single bend is called a bottom, which may be covered with cottonwood trees or else be simply a great grass meadow. From the edges of the valley, the land rises abruptly in steep high buttes whose crests are sharp and jagged. This broken country extends back from the river for many miles and has been called always by Indians, French voyageurs, and American trappers alike the Badlands, partly from its dreary and forbidding aspect and partly from the difficulty experienced in traveling through it. Some of the buttes spread out into level plateaus, many miles in extent. Others form chains or rise as steep, isolated masses. Some are of volcanic origin, being composed of masses of scoria. The others of sandstone or clay are worn by water into the most fantastic shapes. In coloring, they are as bizarre as in form. Among the level, parallel strata which make up the land are some of coal. When a coal vein gets on fire, the clay above it is turned into brick, so that where the water wears away the side of a hill, sharp streaks of black and red are seen across it, mingled with the grays, purples, and browns. Some of the buttes are overgrown with gnarled, stunted cedars or small pines, and they are all cleft through and riven in every direction by deep, narrow ravines or by canyons with perpendicular sides. When one is in the Badlands, he feels as if they somehow look, just exactly as Poe's tales and poems sound. Theodore Roosevelt, 1885. Now, the Great American Folk Show, a little place on the radio where we commune with you to share stories, sing songs, and talk to some good people with great voices. Stay with us over the next hour as we bring you poets Bonnie Larson Steiger and Marcus Amacher, writer Gianni Washington, singer-songwriter Melissa Mary Ahern, folk musicians Andy Hedges and Colin Haynes, plus writer and arts educator Julie Wolfson, and caterer and designer Zoe Howell in conversation, the topic collard greens and black-eyed peas. And Glenn Phillips, founding member of the band Toad the Wet Sprocket, will read a short story. I'm Joe Wiegand. Good to have you with us. Here's your host, Tom Brousseau.
Three guests on today's show are making a return. Toad the Wet Sprocket founding member Glenn Phillips, writer and arts educator Julie Wolfson, and North Dakota Associate Poet Laureate Bonnie Larson Steiger. It's a pleasure to have them back. We'll hear from Julie and Glenn in just a bit, but I can think of no better way to begin the show today, aside from Joe Wiegand and his notes from the Badlands, then with poet Bonnie Larson Steiger. As James Baldwin once said, poets are finally the only people who know the truth about us. Bonnie Larson Steiger is blessed with vision, words, the ability to just set the right tone and say something everyone can feel.
This poem is dedicated to Melanie Thornburg of Walhalla, North Dakota. Moon Queen, dawn, the rising sun bestows last rites on the partial moon. Surely this waxing gibbous orb will rouse my faraway friend who watches every crescent's crest. Shredded shadows mimic pavement ribboning across the prairies between us. Still, she sleeps near the Pembina Gorge, unaware this lunar lemon slice will not wait for her to stir. Pearled curls of clouds lays away from the extinguished candle's flame, a graceful nocturnal exit. Alas, the mystery of this moment fades through a scrim of bent branches and morning snow.
I have here sitting in front of me four compact discs, all released by the same gentleman, Mr. Andy Hedges of Lubbock, Texas. One of the CDs is entitled Shadow of a Cowboy, another Cowboy Recitations, and the other two, Cowboy Songster Volume 1 and Cowboy Songster Volume 2. These albums, through poem and through song, relay all kinds of sentiment on subjects such as work, weather, relationship, and the unknown. In addition to being an accomplished guitar player, singer and collector of folk songs, a reciter of cowboy poetry, Mr. Hedges runs a podcast called Cowboy Crossroads, where he, quote, interviews a different guest and asks them to share stories and discuss music, poetry, and culture from the working cowboy, West and beyond, end quote. If this is your first time hearing about Andy Hedges, you pleasantly get the point already that here's an individual with real folkways zest. Songwriter and performer Tom Russell had this to say about Andy Hedges. This cowboy songster is not just a contender, he's the real deal. Hold fast, hang and rattle, spur wild the cowboy dream, and listen.
Going to leave Old Texas now, they got no use for the longhorn cow. They've plowed and fenced my cattle range, and the people there are all so strange. I take my gun and I take my rope and I'll hit the trail at a long slow lope. Turn my face toward Mexico and I'll say adios to the Alamo. Make my home on the wide, wide range. The people there are not so strange. The hard, hard ground will be my bed, and a saddle seat will hold my head. And when I awaken from my dreams, I'll eat my bread and my sardines. And when my time on earth is done, I'll ride the trail to the Holy One. I'll tell Saint Peter when I go, cowboy soul ain't pure like snow. But in that far off cattle land, he sometimes acted like a man. I'm going down the road feeling bad. Lord, I'm going down the road feeling bad. Lord, I'm going down the road feeling bad. And I ain't gonna be treated this way. And I'm going where the dust storms never blow. Lord, I'm going where the dust storms never blow. Lord, I'm going where the dust storms never blow. And I ain't gonna be treated this way. And I'm going where the water tastes like wine. Lord, I'm going where the water tastes like wine. Lord, I'm going where the water tastes like wine. And I ain't gonna be treated this way. Going to leave old Texas now. They got no use for the longhorn cow. They've plowed and fenced my cattle range, and the people there are all so strange.
Writer and arts educator Julie Wolfson, who was on the Great American Folk Show earlier this year in May with a piece on gefilte fish, wrote me with an idea to interview her friend and colleague Zoe Howell. The topic? Collard greens and black-eyed peas. And I have the feeling that after their conversation, you'll be prompted, dear listener, to want to go ahead and find a good recipe and whip up a batch of collard greens and black-eyed peas for yourself. In fact, I've got my own plate in front of me now, and I just can't hold out. Allow me to take just a quick little bite before I continue. Oh, yeah. That is good. Excuse me. As I mentioned, Julie Wolfson is a writer and arts educator. Zoe Howell is a longtime caterer, designer, and creative consultant. Visit her Etsy table art and home goods store, Pollen and Nectar. Colorful African table liners and pillows are among her special offerings. It's nice to have Julie Wolfson back on the show, and a big warm welcome to Zoe Howell. Here's to Black Eyed Peas and Collard Greens.
It's Christmas time in Hollis, Queens. Mom's cooking chicken and collard greens.
Julie Wolfson here with my friend Zoe Howell. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Julie.
Zoe and I are here to talk about holiday food traditions.
And cooking.
Yes, and cooking. My family shares some holiday food traditions. Braided challah bread for Shabbat on Friday night, crispy potato latkes for the 8 nights of Hanukkah, and gefilte fish for Passover. My grandmother Ruth, who lived just a few months shy of her 100th birthday, always ate a hot dog on July 4th. And in the last few years at my house, we've also added a new tradition of serving smoked turkey with raw cranberry relish on cornbread waffles for Thanksgiving. I love shopping for ingredients and cooking for the holidays. Last December, I was at the farmer's market with you, Zoe.
Yes, that morning I was on the hunt for fresh collard greens. Julie, you and I love the farmer's market. We are always seeking the best, the most fresh, and the most alive ingredients. We bumped into each other that day at the Hollywood Farmers Market right at the Givens Farm stall, where I just spotted gorgeous collard greens. I think I bought all of them.
It was a few days before New Year's Eve, and you began to tell me about your holiday cooking plans. It was time to cook up a big pot of black-eyed peas and another with collard greens, traditionally known as Hoppin' John in the South, and a necessary combination to bring good luck and fortune for the new year. This was the moment I realized I've never grown up with a clear New Year's Eve tradition, unless you count that we usually, but not always, drink a glass of champagne. So on that New Year's Eve, I headed over to your apartment in Hollywood with a bottle of champagne to learn about your family traditions. You stirred and tasted and seasoned the beans and greens. The aroma wafted up from the pots on the stove, and it was somehow both of earth and otherworldly smells, like salt and soil and herbs and magic. And then we packed up big containers and headed over to your friend Delphine's house, where we cooked up a pot of rice and served everyone bowls with beans and greens at midnight. I really want to know more about this tradition.
The traditions are rooted in Southern history. Back in the Civil War and various stages throughout history for enslaved Black people, black-eyed peas and collard greens were always accessible. And if you had access to the ingredients, cornbread was as well. You lived on what was available. There's a lot of folklore around meanings behind these symbols of luck and prosperity and why and where they originated. Some research says during the Civil War, soldiers raided the supplies and would steal everything except for salt pork and the beans, leaving behind the poor man's food. The slaves took what was left and turned it into food that would often sustain them for months. While the soldiers felt these foods were undesirable, the slaves actually felt lucky to have them left behind. They at least had something to survive on. Honestly, it was all a matter of perception. A lot of people lived on these dry goods and staples. Much of folklore points to the peas as the first symbol of luck. The collard greens signify prosperity and wealth due to their rich green color, which symbolizes our currency. Beautiful golden cornbread symbolizes a brick of gold.
And then you told me that you learned that there was a possible connection to Judaism, that the black-eyed peas have been a good luck symbol in the Talmud too, to celebrate Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year.
So interesting, right? I read that it is possible that the tradition came to America with Sephardic Jews who first arrived in Georgia in the 1730s.
I've always said how much we have in common, only my mom didn't cook anything special for New Year's. Did your mom make these dishes for you growing up? Did she teach you how to make them?
As a kid, it was always about mom making black-eyed peas. She would slowly simmer them all day on December 31st. She had a crock pot going with the peas, and on the stove would be a pot of the greens. Both would simmer for a long time with some piece of salt pork, and Mom would use ham hock, neck bones, whatever she could get to put in there to season it. You want the saltiness to balance out the bitterness of the greens, and the smokiness of the peas really pairs well with the pork. There was always a pot of buttery rice. We would have a table filled with all our favorite foods. Sweet yams, macaroni and cheese, and often fried fish would be served. Our tradition has always been to eat a bite of the peas and greens at the stroke of midnight. It was the very first thing you were to do in the new year to solidify good luck and prosperity.
Over the years, you've become an accomplished cook. You've had your own catering company in New York. You've worked here for a Japanese farmer in California, and have done consulting for culinary companies. Have you changed your New Year's recipes over the years?
It has evolved a bit over the years, actually. I buy the black-eyed peas, the greens, the ham hock, the onion, all from the farmer's market. And I feel that there is an extra layer of life in all of that because it is so fresh, and I love dealing directly with my farmers. I cook my collards for less time. Short cooking the greens keeps them more bright on the palate, and they have more of a bite and texture. I also came up with a great vegan version using slowly caramelized onions instead of the ham hock to flavor the peas and greens.
In my family, we have relatives who live in Japan, and they eat many dishes called osechi for good luck on New Year's. I also have family from Colombia and learned about a tradition of eating 12 grapes and making a wish at midnight.
I love it. I have a friend from Beijing whose grandmother and mom always make a ton of pork dumplings for the Chinese New Year. The pig symbolizes wealth and good fortune.
I'd be happy to try all of these traditions. This year, we can all use some extra good fortune and luck. If these rituals and traditions can bring us that, I'm all for it.
Agreed. Let's all practice or even start a tradition for good luck and fortune this New Year's.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays.
All been easy, good and breezy. Crazy about them greasy green.
Melissa Mary Ahern is a songwriter, singer, and performer. She's been releasing original music independently the last couple of years, but this year, 2020, she signed a record contract with Fat Cat Records. And in September, her new single, Hard Luck in Love, was issued. And my oh my, is it a lovely song. We'll hear Melissa Mary Ahern sing it, and we'll also hear a brand new composition entitled Cry Wolf. But first, let's get to know her. And I think I've got the phone all queued up here. Hello, Melissa. Tell us a little bit about yourself, would you? And welcome.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me on the show and for asking me to share a bit about myself. My name is Melissa Mary Ahern, and I live in Brooklyn, New York, where I've been for the past 10 years or so. I'm originally from upstate New York, born in Buffalo, and moved to a few different towns growing up, all within the western New York area. Songwriting has been a passion of mine since about middle school, when I first really learned who the artists were behind some of the songs that I loved. I remember hearing John Lennon sing Imagine and the heartbreak that came when I learned he had died before I was born. Singers like Billie Holiday and Patsy Cline brought on a similar feeling. I've always had a curiosity for who wrote the song, how they lived, and what happened throughout their lives. That was kind of how it started. The art of songwriting itself was very appealing and mysterious to me then, and still is now. I also work part-time in a doctor's office doing massage therapy. It's something I enjoy and feel it brings a sense of balance into my life. Sometimes I can isolate and work alone on music for weeks without really thinking of others or my surroundings. This job helps me put the focus into something else and turn the artist switch off, half the week anyway. I really see music as a slow marathon I've been running, and I hope to share many songs throughout my life that touch people and help them in some way, even if on a micro level. Thanks again for having me, and hope to see you soon.
Hard luck in love, struck down again. Hard luck in love, we've we've reached the end. I didn't know you all that long, just enough to write out a song and call it hard luck. Hard, hard luck in love. Hard luck in love. Nobody's to blame. Hard luck in love. Ain't it a shame? Never guaranteed the long run. It's been hard luck, hard, hard luck in love. Still, I hope I brought you higher. 'Cause now I feel 2 inches taller. And if you think of me, hard luck in love, can I catch a break? Hard luck in love, for goodness sake. I wonder if it's gonna end, or will I be forever mending my hard luck, hard, hard luck in love. My hard, hard, hard luck in love. Still, I know I learned some lessons, and I should be counting my blessings. If you think of me some nights when you're lonely, I hope you don't call. Hope you don't call, hope you don't call me. I hope you don't call, hope you don't call me.
Come and see, cry, cry, cry. see what's on TV.
Marcus Amaker is an all-around, multi-talented individual, musician, graphic designer, teacher, and a poet. In fact, he's the inaugural poet laureate of Charleston, South Carolina, a distinction that was bestowed upon him only a couple of weeks after the position was established by Charleston's City Council in June of 2016. Marcus Amaker is the spotlight of today's Great American Folk Show.
Hey everybody, this is Marcus Amaker. I am the poet laureate of Charleston, South Carolina, actually Charleston's first poet laureate, which is an honor that I am very, very proud of. I'm also a musician and graphic designer. I got connected with Tom because of my work with No Depression. I'm the graphic designer for that journal, and I guess I am biased in thinking this, but I do think that No Depression is one of the best, or if not the best, resource for folk music in the country, honestly. But I'm happy to be on this show as an artist and talk to you all a little bit about my work. So I think what's important for you all to know is the first thing that I ever created was a song called Big Butt when I was 10 years old, and I'll play a little bit of that for you now.
I try to sit down in my chair, but my butt's hanging out everywhere. I got a big butt. I have to go to the bathroom, so I close the door, but my jeans drop on the floor. I got a big butt.
Yeah, so that's still probably the best thing that I ever did, but that all started because I was really inspired and still am inspired by the work of Prince and Joni Mitchell. And Prince and Joni Mitchell are two of my biggest influences, and I was just inspired to create because of them. Since then, I have written 8 books, and the latest book is called The Birth of All Things. And here is a snippet of a poem from that book called The America I Know Could Use a Good Cry.
I met America at a neighborhood bar. He offered me a shot of rum, and I reminded him that Captain Morgan was a slave owner, so the bartender awkwardly slipped another liquid lie down my throat. I ordered another drink and was channeled by dark spirits, the courage of black ghosts who haunt American dreams. I told him...
Yeah, so in addition to poetry and graphic design, I've continued making music. I am an electronic musician, and I've actually put out 32 albums as an electronic artist under the name Tape Loop. The latest album was just released, and it's also a short film, and it's called Subversive, and I'll play a little bit of a song for you from that.
What is honey to a bee but an addiction?
And in addition to poetry and music and all that stuff, I have released 2 albums with a Grammy Award-winning drummer. His name is Quentin Baxter, and Quentin is a member of Rinky Tanky, who we've actually profiled in No Depression, but they won a Grammy last year, and I'm proud to do this work with him. But this is a song from our last album called Empath. We have a new album coming out in 2021. Scientists say that hurricanes are caused by heat energy. Tropical storms of warm water that swarm to form. So thank you again for listening to my work, especially for sitting through Big Butt. I appreciate you all, and you can find me online, charlestonpoet.com. Hope to see you all online soon.
We'd like to take a moment now and thank our sponsor, Hugo's Family Marketplace. Groceries, bakery, deli, floral, you name it. Hugo's, local and family-owned, serving 10 locations in North Dakota and Minnesota since 1939.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's Glenn Phillips to read a short story. Here's When JFK Came to UND.
We will serenade our dreams while life and voice shall last. Then we'll pass and be forgotten with the rest.
In January of 1962, my mother took me to the county courthouse to register for the military draft. I just turned 18, and all 18-year-old boys had to do that. Mom was pretty blue that day, in part because I was a senior in high school and would soon be moving away to college. But she was also worried, worried because there was trouble in Southeast Asia, and many young men were being sent there to fight in a war none of us could relate to. I know she felt the same way when my brother had to register the following year. My dad was worried too. He had fought long and hard in World War II. The war, as we still called it, and he didn't want either of his boys to have to go through what he went through. But it was our duty to register for the draft and go fight if we were called. No one in our family thought it would be right to resist. Since I was in good health, I got a 1A classification, meaning I was fit to go off to war if called. However, our president then was John F. Kennedy, and he had proclaimed that young men could get a deferment from the draft if they stayed in college and kept their grades up and got their degrees. That meant at least 4 years, and surely the fighting in Southeast Asia would be over by then. Everyone loved President Kennedy. We called him JFK. He'd been in the war. He'd written a book about it that we all read in high school called Profiles in Courage, about great American heroes. He had started the Peace Corps, and he had recruited role models such as the Olympic champion Rafer Johnson to inspire young people to do great things. We were all inspired by JFK. So I went off to college at the University of North Dakota with my draft card in my wallet. It said I was now 1AD, meaning I would be deferred from the draft as long as I was making progress in college. But I would still have to check in with the draft board every year. Once in college, all freshman boys were required to enroll in ROTC, the Reserve Officers Training Corps. We called it ROTC, and we had to take it for at least 2 years. We were issued uniforms, and we had to learn how to march and shoot an M1 rifle. Twice a week, we took classes on such things as map reading and military tactics. We were taught the chain of command and told what was expected of us if we were ever taken prisoner by the enemy. Our instructors were veterans of the Korean War, where they had all been non-coms, non-commissioned officers, and none of them had ever been to college. They were skeptical of us young college kids, especially to think that if we did go into the service, we would go in as second lieutenants. They were skeptical of our ability to lead other soldiers in combat. All of us in ROTC were skeptical of that too, but most of us did not foresee that we would actually be called to serve once we finished school. Some of my classmates were more inspired by the thought of military service, and they stayed in ROTC for their junior and senior years also. They became platoon leaders for the underclassmen. Most of these upperclassmen entered the military right after college, and many were sent directly overseas. So that's how it was in September of 1963, when I was just starting my sophomore year at UND, when we heard that the President of the United States, JFK himself, would be coming to UND and speaking in the field house on campus. Tens of thousands of people were expected to be present in hopes of catching a glimpse of JFK, and all of us ROTC students were going to be part of his security team. We were going to be in charge of crowd control. When I think about it now, putting 18 and 19-year-old college boys from North Dakota in charge of anything seems ludicrous, and we were going to be helping protect the President of the United States. That's almost in the realm of fairy tales. When the big day came, all of us gathered outside the field house to get our assignment. The President and his entourage would be coming in by helicopter and landing on the softball fields adjacent to the field house. 1,000 boys, all dressed up like little toy soldiers, would be linking arms and surrounding the field and pushing back against the throngs of spectators. We were told to keep our backs to the crowd, and under no circumstances were we to allow anyone to cross our lines. It was critical that we not break rank, for that might allow the crowd to swarm the President. No one imagined anyone would want to purposefully harm JFK. The worry was that he'd be hurt by someone who loved him too much. Our platoon leader, a guy named Phil, told me to stand near the point where the President was to exit the landing field. He did it as a favor to me, and I never knew why. The President flew into the Air Force base west of town and came to the campus by helicopter. A few minutes before he landed, we could hear the sound of the chopper coming in. It was exciting, and it was scary. I was standing next to my friend Bill, whose dad was a professor at UND. There were thousands of people crowded in behind us. They were already starting to push against the line. We held tight and braced ourselves. Just one single chopper landed, but it was a big one, and it made a deafening noise. Once it was on the ground, we watched as JFK and his bodyguards got off and were met by local officials and politicians. After a round of handshakes, they piled into a couple of Cadillac convertibles and headed right towards where I was standing. JFK ordered the car he was in to stop when they got to our line, and he got out and started reaching across the ROTC guys and shaking hands with some of the spectators. He wasn't supposed to do that, and the Secret Service guys who surrounded him looked nervous when he did. They were the toughest looking men I have ever seen. And there was the President of the United States, just a few feet away from me, reaching out to his adoring fans. It was a beautiful day, but it seemed like the sun's rays were all focused on JFK. He was all aglow, smiling and reflecting the light onto the people he touched. And then, without warning, my friend Bill let go of me and the other guy on the side of him and walked towards the President. It must have looked very suspicious to the Secret Service, and they muscled him out of the way, but not before he shook the President's hand. I had grabbed the guy who'd been positioned on the other side of Bill. We were really straining against the surging crowd, but we held on. And we didn't let Bill back in line until the President had entered the field house. We were all disgusted with him for breaking rank. Once JFK was inside the field house, the crowd outside relaxed a bit, but we kept our arms linked, just as we were told to do. There were thousands of people waiting for the President inside the field house. They cheered for a long time, and when he spoke, they seemed to break out in cheers about every 5 minutes. After about an hour, JFK emerged from the field house and got into the waiting car, and this time they drove right to the chopper. JFK didn't shake any hands this time, but he smiled and waved to the people, and they all went wild. Everyone loved JFK, Republicans and Democrats alike. All of us ROTC boys held strong as the President boarded the chopper and lifted off the field. Then our platoon leader came and told us we could disperse. But the people who'd come to see the President stayed for a long time, talking about what they'd seen. Everyone knew that Bill had broken rank, the only one of the 1,000 ROTC students to do so. We figured he'd get some kind of punishment, but he never did. And really, what could they do to him? Give him a dishonorable discharge from ROTC? He was a college student. Some of us thought he got off easy because his dad was a professor. Who knows? The worst part was, Bill never showed the slightest remorse for his behavior. In fact, he bragged about it. And that's what I'll always remember him for. Yes, I was jealous too. He had actually touched the President.
President Kennedy spoke at the university September 25th. All university afternoon classes have been adjourned, and the Johnstone Fulton Dance have been canceled. The campus, like the nation, is only slowly adjusting to the shock. Good afternoon.
2 months later, JFK was riding in another motorcade in Dallas when he was shot and killed by a sniper. All of us who'd been on campus when he visited us were appalled. Everyone in the country went into mourning. But we knew that nothing like that could have happened at UND. People from North Dakota would never even think of such a thing. My friend, the deserter, Bill, was in a bad accident later that year. He was injured to the point that his draft status was changed to 4F. That meant he would never be called to serve. And Phil, the guy who stationed me where I'd get to see the president up close, he graduated and went into the service. He was sent to a war zone in Vietnam. One day while he was on patrol, he was shot and killed by a sniper, just as JFK had been. Years later, I went to see the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. I knew his name would be engraved there somewhere, but I never saw it because I couldn't remember his last name. And I guess that's the way life is. We meet and mingle and laugh together, and sometimes we share momentous experiences. But then we go our separate ways, and a few years later, we don't even remember each other's names. And then, like it says in the Whiffenpoof song, we pass and are forgotten with the rest.
Gianni Washington is an avid reader and a writer from Baltimore, Maryland. She received a master's in writing from Otis College in Los Angeles, California, and a creative writing PhD from the University of Surrey in Guildford, England. Her latest tale is of a dollmaker named Miles, but these just aren't any dolls. We all know that nothing could ever replace a loved one lost, but the dolls that Miles makes in his shop, they come pretty close. The story is called Homunculus, which is Latin for little man, and you might say this little piece of fiction is fresh out of the box. Gianni is still putting the finishing touches on it. We'll continue with Homunculus Part 2 in the new year, but here's Gianni Washington now with Part 1.
Homunculus. The bodies slump in the corner, their empty eye sockets gaping at nothing in particular. Arms, legs, fingers entwined. This immobile audience oversees Miles at his work, silently critical. He presses the faux skin to its muscle and bone gently, gently. He must wear gloves. It's important that the ridges in his fingertips do not infiltrate the surface of the doll. The figures must at least appear to be of nature's making. After completely clothing one arm in a pallid sheath of fake skin, Miles removes one glove and shakes the open hand with his eyes closed. Yes, it feels as if he is palm to warm palm with a young lady. Success. Now on to the rest of the body. You can't keep doing this, Esther says. She peeks over Miles's shoulder and gazes at him from the creased corners of her eyes. I know, Miles says, but keeps working. His client had made a down payment after all. It won't help him, in the end, she says without feeling. Her lifeless eyes rove his workspace. Bins brim with synthetic hair. Glossy eyes made of glass nearly spill from an open drawer. Their irises blue, brown, hazel, green, and gray. Miles fingers the bodiless arm delicately. It's coated in a self-heating substance, with firm rubber muscles and plastic bones underneath. Miles uses a time-tested mixture of additives with the silicone he buys from foreign retailers. It had taken him over a decade, but he'd finally hit upon the perfect combination of ingredients to make the skin of his creations feel eerily human. Esther turns her head on her thin neck toward Miles, then rests her round little girl chin upon his shoulder. "Did it help you?" she asks. "I'm not lonely anymore, am I?" Miles answers. He presses a plastic fingernail hard against the drop of glue meant to fasten it in place. Esther watches Miles' skin turn an angry pink through the viewfinder of his thumbnail. He releases the pressure. The pink softens to a pale peach. I can't imagine my life without you, he says. A slow grin crawls into place above Esther's chin, settling there. Of course you can. She kisses his stubbled cheek. That's why I'm here. Like every day since the one on which her eyes first clicked open and locked onto his in recognition, Esther is right. She is always right.
I found out about our next guest, Colin Haynes, who's from Fort Wayne, Indiana, because we're both part of the same Carter Family Appreciation Group on Facebook called the Carter Family Group. And anyone can join, by the way. It's a good group in my eyes because it resurfaces materials about the Carter family that haven't been seen or read in a while. Performances, articles, photos. Interesting and important documents on the first family of country music that have yet to really be digitized. And as it turns out, Colin happens to be the one who founded the Carter Family Group, and he's just 17 years old. Well, I bet old AP, Mother Maybelle, and Sarah are looking down right now, pleased as punch, to know that their music has found yet another generation of hearts. Recently, I happened upon a video posted by Colin. He was playing a tune on the auto harp, and I just loved it. And I thought what a fun idea it would be to invite him on the Great American Folk Show, show how talented this young man is, and hopefully inspire a few listeners out there to dust off their auto harp and get scratching. Well, I'm going to let him take it away now. It's Kid Colin Haynes.
Before I play this next song here on the auto harp, I want to give a special thanks to a very important lady in my life, and someone who I probably wouldn't be here on this radio show if it wasn't for her, and that's my grandmother, Dee Stoner. Ever since I could play just the first three chords on the guitar, it was G, C, and D7, she had me out performing for people at church and friends and family at home, and I'm really grateful for that. So Dee, I'll play this next song for you. Thank you for all you've done for me. This is a tune I learned listening to Mother Maybelle Carter play the auto harp, called Chinese Breakdown.
Chinese Breakdown.
Great American Folk Show would like to thank Bonnie Larson-Steiger, Marcus Amacher, Andy Hedges, Colin Haynes, Gianni Washington, Glenn Phillips, Julie Wolfson, Zoe Howell, and Melissa Mary Ahern. Special thanks to Jim Brousseau, who wrote the short story When JFK Came to UND. Andy Stack of Buffalo Stack Productions in Beacon, New York. Bill Polinuk of Bill Polinuk Studios, Belfield, North Dakota. Opening theme by Sean Watkins in Los Angeles, California. End theme by Berkham Boys in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Our sponsor, Hugo's Family Marketplace. The Great American Folk Show was written and recorded by Tom Brousseau. Produced and edited by Eric Detheridge and Bill Thomas. I'm Joe Wiegand. May you always find the sun until we meet again.
For more information about this program, please visit prairiepublic.org. On the next episode of the Great American Folk Show, musicians Kyle Fields, Eliza Blue, Elisa Flynn, painter Molly Douthat, our very own Joe Wiegand will be back with Notes from the Badlands and more. We'll see you then.